Hello everyone, and welcome to the Science Bloggers podcast. I'm your host, David Latchman, and my guest this week is Stephanie Schuttler. Stephanie is a wildlife biologist who studied the African forest elephant for her PhD. She's also the owner of the Fancy Scientist blog. In our talk, Stephanie recounts part of her journey into science. She says she was not always the smartest person in class and did not have any strong mentors to show her the way. She originally planned to pursue a career in acting, with medical school as a sort of a backup. It was during her study abroad time in Kenya that she decided to become a wildlife biologist. And getting into graduate school was not that straightforward. You know, this was a time before the internet and social media. In her field in wildlife biology, grad school applicants had to contact the head of research groups and see if they would take them on as students. My experience in physics was somewhat different. We were all over the place. Some schools encouraged you to contact professors. Some said, yeah, you can. Some said you absolutely had to. And others actively discouraged that. So I know the experience that, you know, not knowing where to find this information and trying to figure it out as you apply to graduate school can be pretty daunting. Stephanie also describes herself as someone who's interested in jewelry and fashion. And as you might expect, that does not quite fit with many people's image of a biologist who works in the field. For her research, Stephanie uses camera traps to study wildlife around the world. And she talks about the impact that this has had on communities, especially on citizen scientists. We also talk about her podcast, the Fancy Scientist Podcast, and her upcoming book. So, hello, Stephanie. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for inviting me on your podcast.
Well, it's great to have you. So, why don't we start by telling the listeners something about yourself and what you do?
I am in a weird stage of my life, actually. I transitioned recently into a full-time career doing science communication. I'm actually doing something kind of experimental. I'm not sure if anybody else is doing this, but I'm essentially turning my blog, Fancy Scientist, into a business. So how I got here, it's a very long-winded path, but in brief, we can talk about my background in wildlife biology and how I got there. But I entered wildlife biology because I was really interested in conservation biology. So any research I was doing, I was really interested in having a conservation application. And what I found from being in this field for so long is that, yes, of course, science is important, but a lot of conservation problems, if you study the animal, it doesn't necessarily help alleviate the threat. So I worked on forest elephants. So an example with them was they were being poached really badly. And no matter how much we could study the elephant, anything we learned about them wasn't necessarily going to help them until the poaching stopped. So I started to have a shift in perspectives. I also was working with kids in classrooms, and I really liked that. And I just love talking about the research and getting people excited about animals. I've given a lot of talks having worked at a museum. So I just decided that that this is going to be my new career. So since February. So for a couple of months, I'm doing this full time now.
Okay, that's because I've looked at your blog, right? And, you know, you talk about your work. I've also looked at some of the posts on your wildlife photography where you use camera traps. So can you tell us a little bit about that work that you do or did?
Sure. Yeah, I worked as a postdoc at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences on the eMammal Project. This is a citizen science camera trapping project. And my specific role, I was hired under a large NSF grant to implement citizen science into K through 12 classrooms, and specifically middle school. So citizen science is basically a form of science where anyone can participate. And you might have to take some training to learn how to use equipment or learn how to do some data analysis, but you don't have to have a degree in science. So the challenge for my postdoc was to figure out how to implement our research, which was camera traps, into classrooms and have it also align with the science standards that teachers had to teach. So students, instead of doing laboratory exercises, would be doing this real scientific research as part of their science learning. And then at the same time, I also had to think about how to make the research meaningful to scientists as well. So we didn't just want them setting up camera traps and not necessarily having the data be high quality and we can't use it. We wanted the data to be real. And for those of you who don't know, camera traps are the real cameras and they are triggered by heat and motion. So whenever an animal walks by, it snaps a picture of it. So it's a really great way for us to spy on animals in the forest. Scientists have seen animals that they thought were extinct in certain areas from these camera traps, extremely elusive animals. I know people who studied jaguars and have only seen jaguars like three times over, I think, like a decade of work. But you get them on the camera traps all the time. So it's a really great way to study wildlife.
And yeah, it's very interesting to see, you know, a lot of these animals that I guess you typically wouldn't see in a normal program, you know, on TV or on a documentary in that way. So for the citizen scientists that take part, what has the response been? What age groups are these citizen scientists?
For our entire volunteer program, so our e-mammal program in North Carolina had various projects associated with it. We had a project where we were across Raleigh in Washington, D.C. We were studying how development affected mammals. And then we had a statewide project where we tried to get camera trap data in every county and distributed across the different habitat types in North Carolina. And for those projects, we basically opened it up to anyone who wanted to participate. Mostly our volunteers were, they tended to be a little bit older, more educated. We actually had a lot of people who they had careers like already interest or involving science. So we're in North Carolina, we're in the research triangle. So in retrospect, that's not that surprising. So that's typically what you get for citizen science in general. If you look at, I've done a little research as well across citizen science projects. So people tend to be older because they have more, if they're retired, they have more time. And for citizen science projects, it can be a big access issue because if you are, you know, working two jobs, if you have kids, you don't have the time to do this stuff. So the thing that I really loved about working in the classrooms is that the classrooms that we worked with in North Carolina were incredibly diverse. So people, obviously they're all the same age, but different ethnicities, you know, children come in from different countries, some of them Spanish speaking, they don't know English yet. So it was an opportunity for us to reach completely new audiences. And the great thing about working with kids, too, is they were so excited about getting the photos. And this was true of the adults, too. Everyone loves getting the photos. It's so much fun. That they would go home and they would tell their parents and their families about it. And this is kind of an indirect way to spread scientific knowledge. And what I really hope is like these increased connections to nature, that people see these animals, that a lot of them are actually quite common, but like you said, they don't get to see them up close. So we get a lot of foxes on our camera traps, but people hardly ever see foxes, you know, in their everyday lives. So yeah, people loved the project. They were super excited about it. And I loved working in the schools because we're able to work with people who may not be able to do citizen science otherwise.
You know, I think that's a very cool way to bring, you know, wildlife to the general public, because we don't always have that opportunity to be up close and personal for various reasons. Actually, for this season, you know, you haven't been the only wildlife biologist. There was one previous one who was an aquarist, and there's an upcoming episode with, you know, a guest who did VR for marine biology. And, you know, both ways are good ways, you know, to say expose people to the wildlife around them and get them interested and get them interested in conservation. So, you know, I think it's really cool that you're doing that. But I've also looked at your blog, and you seem to travel the world. So what are the relationships like in terms of like the government that in those countries that you visit and the organizations that you work with there?
So I work with several different organizations internationally. We received a grant really right when I started my postdoc in 2014. And the goal of the grant was to connect different museums around the world in a subject area. It didn't have to be science. It could have been history or anything. And it applied to kids as well. And they had to have cultural exchanges as well. So it just didn't have to be about the science. So we had, we set up to work with the Natural History Museum in Bombay, India, and the Museo de Guadalajara in Guadalajara, Mexico. And it was just so great working with these museums. They're still running camera traps in Mexico and in India. India actually grew its project. So with the money from the grant, we had a training session in Mexico, and we also had money to bring over some teachers and some children from the program for an event in the United States in North Carolina. So that was just, you know, really cool to see them do that. And the kids gave speeches, and we had like a whole week with doing lots of fun outdoor activities. But yeah, I mean, everyone has really been on board. We haven't really had any problems with the program. In Mexico, the director of the museum, she actually organized for the children to present the results, the photos, to the mayor of Guadalajara. She invited him and he came. That was a direct example of them interacting with government officials. And in India, they applied for their own grant from an Indian bank and was awarded a pretty big sum of money to purchase more camera traps. And they expanded their research to like 20 schools across the western side of India. And for us, from a data perspective, that's really amazing, because if you only have one school participating, you really can't do that much with the data, because a single camera trap site is a single sample. So you really need multiple locations. And that was one of the challenges in working with schools, is trying to get enough schools to adopt it, that you have locations in the right area. But with India and them having all those camera trap locations through the schools participating, it was really great from a data perspective and also from a educational perspective as well.
That sounds like it's really cool. And I like that, you know, you're going to these countries that, you know, may not necessarily have the resources to do this kind of work, and now they can. So that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and now we're getting countries to reach out to us too. So we had this professor at a university in Chile reach out to us, and he received some funding to be able to do this. So we worked with three schools there, and they had a lot of camera traps per school. And they actually did like a real scientific study with it. And it was kids setting it up and doing all the work.
So it sounds like your postdoc research in this area has finished. Do you plan to return to this area anytime in the future?
I would like to still stay involved in it. I am still affiliated with the museum, and I still manage the e-mammal projects that I started. So we have to expert review all of the photos because the volunteers identify which animal they think it is, and a lot of people miss animals or were able to identify animals that they consider unknown. So we really have to check every single photo. So I'm part of eMammal through that way still by reviewing the photos. I still have a lot of research left to do for my postdoc that I need to write up. I'm delayed on that. So I'll definitely be doing that. But I would like to stay in touch and work with eMammal, but just maybe not be a lead researcher and writing the grants to find new projects. I serve as the co-chair for the Communications and Outreach Committee for Wildlife Insights, which is a large camera trap initiative between eight different conservation science organizations and Google. And the whole goal of Wildlife Insights is to bring together camera trap images from all over the world. Because lots of people are setting up these camera traps. There's a lot of graduate students and college professors and government officials, and they might be setting up camera traps to study a specific species, say a mountain lion, but you get a lot of species as what we call bycatch on the camera trap. And there's probably a lot of other scientists who are either studying a different species and they can use those data or just use them as part of a larger research question. So our goal is to bring all the camera trap data together into one database and also create a platform with artificial intelligence to automatically identify the species. Because right now, camera trap data is pretty slow. In North Carolina, a single camera trap probably gets like a couple of hundred photos, not too many. But we also have camera traps in Kenya. And because there's so many large mammals there, like you can easily get thousands and thousands of photos on a camera trap. And there's also a lot of goats and cows and stuff. So once Wildlife Insights, we do have artificial intelligence working, and it should be out really soon for researchers to be able to use. We're testing it right now with a lot of different kinds of users. But that should be able to cut down our workload a lot, and then we can have more information about animals in closer to real time than what we have right now.
You know, actually, my next question was going to be the use of AI, or if it could be used, because I'd imagine when you were talking that there's going to be so much data from these camera traps that eventually a couple of humans can't process all that data quickly enough, and then you just get this huge backlog that becomes unmanageable. So
yeah.
How good is the AI at identifying these animals, this wildlife?
It depends on the species. I don't know off the top of my head. But if you go to Wildlife Insights, I believe they have a page available where you can look at the results from the AI. But so, for example, here in North Carolina, white-tailed deer, I believe it identifies it to something like 98%, because there's really no other animal that looks like a white-tailed deer. But if you're in a state where they overlap with mule deer, that rate probably goes down a lot. So it depends on the animals and the environment. Some animals are even really hard for us to tell apart because there's just so little difference in them, morphologically speaking. And I do think it'll be slow, maybe a little apprehensive adoption until people get used to AI. They might want to double check some of their results. But for us, we've been running camera traps so frequently in North Carolina, and over half of them are deer. And about a quarter of them are squirrels, and the AI is pretty good on those. So to like remove those photos alone would save us a lot of time, and people too. The AI is pretty good at identifying people. So removing people photos or false triggers as well. A lot of times camera traps can go off and there's no animal there. So even just getting rid of the non-animal photos or people photos would help decrease the work amount a lot.
That's awesome. It's amazing like what we can train AI to do these days. And I imagine like this AI has to go through a training process. Is it still going through that training process? Or is it ready? And if it's still being trained, is there a way for people to get involved to help with that training the AI?
Yes, it's still being worked on. So Google is our partner for that. I don't think there's a way for people to help out right now because we have so much camera trap data that we do have really good training data sets. Maybe as we progress and we start working on more rare species, we can ask for people to contribute some photos. But right now, it's in the hands of Google, and they're working on improving it constantly.
So let's talk a little bit about your background, right? So from your blog, you describe yourself as the daughter of a jeweler who has an affinity for sparkles, and you love makeup and fashion, or something like that.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that.
So I ended up in wildlife biology totally by accident. I never even knew it was a career. Growing up, I always loved animals. My parents taught me to love animals, but we weren't really outdoorsy people at all. I did do outdoorsy things, but it would always be like in my front yard and backyard, like, or we would travel to like a local pond and look at frogs and snakes. So that's how I grew up loving animals. But the only wildlife biologist I knew of was Jane Goodall. And we would get National Geographic and I would see these big features on her and her living conditions. And when we went to a state park, we would do this every summer. My family would stay in a hotel overnight. So I knew I could not be Jane Goodall, even though what she was doing was super cool. I was like, there's no way I have it in me to do this. So years and years later, when I was in college, I was studying to be an actor. So I was dual majoring in theater and biology. And biology was kind of a backup career because I thought I could be a doctor if acting didn't work out, because acting is a pretty competitive field and a lot of people don't make a big living from it. So the backup plan was to get become a physician. So I majored in biology. And towards the end of my undergrad, my brother just kind of like randomly said to me, like, you should consider studying abroad. And I don't know, it just hit me. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a fun thing to do. So at this point, this was like the early 2000s. So the internet was around, but it wasn't what it is today. So I actually went to the study abroad office and collected all these brochures. And I had a lot for theater, but I had a couple of others that just looked like really cool places to go. And one of those was Kenya. And I just really liked, honestly, the animals on the cover. And I just thought it looked like such a cool experience. And I just was like, when am I ever going to go to Africa again? My family did not really travel either internationally. So I thought that I would never be brave enough to go again. So this was like in a group setting. And I decided to do it. So ironically, it took me all the way going to Kenya for me to learn about jobs in wildlife biology across the world, that, you know, there are jobs you can get here in the United States and in the government, or if you want to do work in Africa, you can work here as a professor and travel back and forth. I thought the only options were to be someone like Jane Goodall and move to the jungles of Tanzania and, you know, live in a tent with no running water and no electricity. So there's a lot of in-betweens. And then after that experience, I learned about graduate school and I decided to go. I took a couple of years off to do some internships and get experience. And then I went to get my PhD after that.
It sounds like one of the biggest problems with most scientific fields is that, you know, many students have no idea that they exist, right? And I guess wildlife biology is a biologist is one of those fields. So how do you think we can get students to be more aware that, you know, these jobs exist, that they can do it, that they can be prepared to study for it?
That's a good question. I think, of course, by making our presence more prominent in the world and in the virtual space, one of the things I really liked about public speaking was that I could directly interact with people. And I think people get the impression that scientists are this like very serious, very kind of like stern person. And I mean, there's definitely people like that out there, but I also want to show that scientists have a personality. They're, you know, regular people. We do regular things. People just don't know scientists in their community. So I think that going out and talking to people is a really great way to change some of those perceptions and show that there are these jobs out there. And I try to do that with social media by posting. I do a Fancy Friday where I post a different fancy scientist every week. And my dad is on my newsletter and he's like, I can't believe those people are scientists because they just, you know, they just look like normal people. Some of them are models. I'm posting one in a couple of weeks. That's a ballerina. So, you know, just people you wouldn't think are scientists when you look at them. So I try to do it that way. And I think other people try to do it that way through social media, and working with teachers, because that's really where kids learn information. My parents didn't go to college. So when I was learning about careers, it was really like, what characters are there in the Little People playset? And what are my guidance counselors telling me? And my school did not do a good job of it. Like the only careers I knew of were like doctor, veterinarian, lawyer, you know, the basic careers. And yeah, I think by working with teachers too and giving them opportunities to talk with scientists.
You know, I agree with like everything that you said. And, you know, one of the things that I always tell people about being a scientist or working in STEM or even being a science communicator, it's that it's a job just like any other job on the planet.
Yes.
And in any of those jobs, you're going to find this huge diversity of people. You know, personality types, you know, even within your scientific field, we're going to have people who are nerds, who aren't that nerdy, right? And, you know, I think that's one takeaway that will be so important for people to understand, that you don't have to fit in that particular niche of being this uber smart, uber nerdy person to be in that field. You know, anyone can do it. Yeah, I'm not saying that to like diminish the field or to, you know, make it seem less than it is. You know, I still think it's awesome, but anyone can do it if their heart is in it and they really want to do it and they're passionate about it. You can be a scientist.
Yes, absolutely. That's the advice I always give to kids, is that, I mean, yes, good grades help you and hard work helps you, but really, if you want to do it, you can do it. You don't have to be the smartest person in the world. You don't have to be the top of your class. And especially for PhD, it's just honestly so much of your PhD is really about putting in the work and perseverance. But I was going to say that in my field in wildlife biology, there really is like a type of wildlife biologist, like what you imagine a wildlife biologist looks like. That's a lot of field clothes, and for women, they don't really wear makeup. So that's why I changed my name to Fancy Scientist, and I embrace this to show the diversity within that field, because I got the impression people would look at me and, you know, see me in a dress and see me in jewelry and be like, oh, she's not serious about field work. I actually found out later that one of my references told one of my bosses that it doesn't look like she would be good in the field, but she is. So I'm doing that to try to defy that stereotype that you can look different ways and you can still like wildlife biology and be good at it.
Yeah, it's, you know, we have a lot of perceptions as to what a scientist looks like. And I guess being a field scientist, you know, we have this rugged impression or this rugged image of what, you know, a person who does that will look like. And I guess it's going to be typically male. And I guess since we lack that diversity in STEM, that person is going to be white as well. And, you know, we really need to break that down. You know, I remember like one time I had interviewed the science advisor for this sci-fi TV show, 12 Monkeys. And I was talking to someone who might have ended up as a mentor. And he was like, there's no way she's a physicist. And I'm like, what do you think a physicist looks like? And this is someone who is an editor for a science publication who thinks like that. You know, so we really need to change not only the public's impression on what a scientist looks like or what a science communicator looks like, but we need to do that within our own field, because that those prejudices still exist, as you just said, you know, with some of your colleagues. So a lot needs to be changed.
Yeah, I agree. We're doing pretty well in wildlife biology in terms of gender diversity. There's actually a lot of women in wildlife biology. And I would say at the student level, women can even outnumber men. But we do still have the problem where as you go higher up in the professor careers, the higher level positions, that it's mostly men.
Yeah, I came from physics, so we're like a lot worse than you guys.
Yeah. Physics is definitely really skewed towards men.
I think like everyone all around, you know, we have a lot of work to do. Yeah, things are getting better, but you know, we still have a lot of work to do, and we should be progressing at a faster rate than we are doing right now. I mean,
yeah,
we can be progressing at a glacial level, and yeah, that's progress, but it's not enough.
The interesting thing about wildlife biology more recently is that a lot of people think that wildlife biology, like you mentioned, is like being really outdoorsy and doing a lot of field work. And now, because of technology, both in terms of how we study the animals, so we put sensors on animals like GPS tracking devices, or we have these camera traps out in the forest. And then also our technology has improved computers so much, so we now have much more statistical capability, that really wildlife biology nowadays is about analyzing big sets of data, which is about statistics and math. So a lot of us are not even really outdoors anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's something that we also have to tell students, how science has changed. So it's not like, okay, I want to be a wildlife biologist, I'm just going to focus on all my biology related courses. Now there's a lot of cross collaboration. So you're working with statisticians, you're working with programmers, you're working with coders, you know, so there are a lot of ways you can get involved, or there are a lot of pathways to some of these fields that you may not necessarily have expected. You know, so it's a lot of work to do. So
yes, absolutely.
So you also talk about other things on your blog. One of them is sustainable fashion and eco-friendly beauty products. So what exactly are those two things?
So again, it has to do with my love for animals and my concern about them indirectly. Like a lot of people think when we say, you know, save wildlife, I think we think of that direct research in the field and reserving land, and all of that stuff is definitely important. But we don't think about how our everyday decisions affect wildlife ultimately. So one of the major goals of my blog is to try to get people to understand that they have this power in what they buy, how much they buy, what companies that they buy from, I'm the daughter of a jeweler, so we had our own family store. So small businesses are really important to me. But even within the past few years, I learned about sustainable fashion kind of indirectly. Just over, I would say, like the past 10 years, I feel like the quality of my clothes has really declined, even though I was shopping at the same stores. And I actually wanted to buy nicer clothes. So I started doing consignment shopping so I could get more expensive brands, but for cheaper. And then through that, I started to learn about how bad the fashion industry is for the environment. I think, I can't remember if the statistic is right, but I think it's the number two polluting industry. And especially now with what they call fast fashion, they constantly want to sell. So they're constantly changing over the trends and creating these cheaper products that are essentially like disposable. Like you pay so little for them that you wear them a couple of times and then that's it. Yeah, I mean, even someone like myself who is in conservation biology didn't really think about this stuff until a couple of years ago. So I'm trying to spread that message and just get people thinking about how what they do and how it impacts their daily lives. For beauty products and cosmetic products, I'm really passionate about this issue just because I learned in the United States how unregulated the industry is. And my family has a history of cancer. My uncle actually passed away from cancer directly working in a chemical factory. And just compared to the European Union, we only ban like 30 ingredients, whereas the European Union bans about 1,400. So I also try to get people to think about it from not only an environment perspective, because what we wash off our bodies ultimately goes into the environment, but also their own health perspective as well, that some of these ingredients might not be completely tested and we don't know exactly what their impact might be.
And, you know, it's an important thing to consider and think about, because the way the market economy works, it's so complex, it's so interconnected that we may not realize how what we do and what we buy, you know, affects that environment. So it's good to have an expert at least talking about it or giving advice on what to do. So yay.
Thank you. Yeah, and I try to do it to bring in a different audience too. So maybe people that are more interested in fashion and not necessarily animals as much, to try to get them to look at other parts of my blog or maybe consider other aspects. But also, I also just felt like the sustainable world only fit like one type of person too, where that person is very minimalist. And even when you look up sustainable clothes, a lot of them are really plain and like neutral colors. And I'm not like that at all. I like bright colors. I like sparkly things. So I kind of did it for myself too. Like, how can I be sustainable and get products that I still like to wear?
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a diverse audience. It's like anyone can be a part of this, so to speak. Get as many people involved as possible.
Yes.
So you also talk about quite a few other things in your blog, and one of them is ethical zoos. And I guess this is partly related to that Netflix series Tiger King. So do you want to talk about that? Exactly what an ethical zoo is and what a zoo should be?
Yes, this was totally sparked by Tiger King. So everyone was telling me I had to watch the documentary. And for those of you who haven't seen it, it's about this man who bred lions and tigers. He was the biggest breeder in the United States. And he did a lot of it for cub petting, which is basically where people pay money to hold cubs. They usually get their pictures taken with them. And then after that, so the cubs are only allowed to be held by the public for about a month of their life. And then after that, they're usually sold. And for tigers, that's illegal in the United States. So it's basically about him doing this and this battle with this woman who's trying to stop this practice in the United States. And it's more about their lives and their relationship with each other. And it's set in the context of zoos and sanctuaries and endangered species. But the Netflix documentary Nowhere brings in experts to talk about this. And I understand it focused on the people, so they didn't need to have a lot. But I just wish they would have had at least a few minutes saying, like, what this person's saying is not right. It's not accurate. Because all the people invested were, you know, they owned these different facilities. So you could, the argument was you could profit off of all of them. Although I disagree with one of the facilities in particular that it's profit-based. So I wanted to write blog posts about this, and there's just so much about it that I felt like I needed to start from scratch and just explain like what zoos do for conservation. And it's especially becoming a touchy subject nowadays as zoos have evolved and people have evolved as we learned more about animals. There is pressure to for zoos to get better, for even for zoos to release certain animals, like elephants being one of them, that are, they require large ranges, they're very social. Can a zoo even provide for them properly? So I basically just wanted to go through like all the ranges of zoos in the United States. And it's not necessarily to say like with a stamp, like this is an ethical zoo and this is an unethical zoo, but just help people understand all of the different factors that go into evaluating a zoo. And of course, some of it is animal welfare, but in the documentary, a lot of people would say that they're doing this for conservation, that they're breeding these animals for conservation. And in their case, they weren't. The animals they were breeding would have never, ever been released into the wild. And they're not necessarily raising the money that they say they are for the conservation of these animals in the wild. So I wanted to clarify a lot on that and really explain how zoos do help conservation projects, because they do fund research. They also really take part in proper species reintroduction programs. And a lot of these species reintroduction programs are not even animals that you hear about. So the famous ones are like the California condor and the black-footed ferret. But behind the scenes, there's, you know, tiny frogs and fish and mussels and butterflies and insects that are endangered species, or in some cases they're even extinct in the wild. And the zoos breed these populations to release them and hopefully be able to have the population thrive again once in the wild.
Yeah, and I think you also talk about the for-profit motive, because I've seen the argument that if we made this more for-profit, that more people would get involved and help these animals, these species, you know, increase their numbers. But in most cases, that the people that kind of thing attracts typically don't want any kind of government rules or government intervention. And then that becomes problematic because they're not helping, you know, the creatures that they say that they care about. So it's a complex subject, I guess. I don't know.
No, it's very complex. And even some of the more ethical zoos that I talk about, they do some things that I necessarily don't agree with. It just basically has to do with like how we interact with wildlife. And nowadays, with selfies being such a major thing, and people are so driven to take pictures with wild animals, I think that if we keep rewarding that behavior, even in a case where maybe it's okay, like say a wild animal is like injured and it can't be released to the wild and it serves as what we call an ambassador animal. If you were to take a selfie of that wild animal, people don't know the difference between that and say going to a country in South America where they're taking sloths from the wild or anteaters from the wild just so that tourists pay money for these selfies. So I tend to go for like the absolute approach where we should have a real clear representation of animals in the wild, even in captivity. So the zoos I tend to prefer and support are those where you watch the animals and they're separated by a barrier and they look like they're in the environment they're supposed to be in their natural, in their native country, to the best of the zoo's ability, that they're able to create a proper exhibit. So I also think that people learn more that way too. I think when people get getting really up close to wildlife is important and it can be impactful, but I think people are so like captivated with being close to the animal and taking pictures and stuff that they don't necessarily learn about the wildlife. And I think they forget that it's wild and they think about it more like a pet. And even Tiger King said that. He said in the documentary that my pets are no different than yours. They just have like 3-inch fangs and weigh, you know, several hundred pounds. And it's like, no, they're totally different. They're not, our pets are domesticated, or our cats and dogs are domesticated. Like they've co-evolved to live with humans for thousands and thousands of years. These tigers, they're just tamed by humans. So it's a gigantic difference.
Yeah, and I think that is an important distinction to make, that these are wild animals, you know, whether you're petting them or not. And, you know, your cats and your dogs are not. They, as you said, co-evolved to cohabitate with us. Hopefully, you know, people will understand that distinction. From your blog, you also have a podcast, the Fancy Scientist Podcast.
Yeah, so that's a new thing. And I honestly, I never necessarily wanted to do a podcast because I had a lot on my plate already. So it wasn't like I was like really wanting to do one. But I listened to a lot of entrepreneurial podcasts and they were talking about the difference between blog and podcasts and YouTube. So I have YouTube too. And like the attention rates of people. So if you think about a blog, anything that you read on the internet, you probably click on it and like scan through it. A lot of people don't read the full thing. Same thing with a YouTube video. They click on it and they listen to it, in a couple of spots, maybe leave early, go to the next video. But with podcasts, people tend to listen more through the entire episode. And I thought about myself, how I listen to podcasts. I listen to them in the car when I'm driving or walking my dogs. And I was like, well, if I really want to reach people, like this is a great way to do it. And I also didn't realize how easy it was. Like, I think a lot of people think when you podcast, you have to have all this crazy equipment. And you really don't. I run this blogging group in Raleigh and we invited somebody who does podcasting for their career. And he's like, you just need your phone at this point. Like if you just want to get started, your phone is honestly like good enough. And if your content is good, that's really what people care about. Like you need to come up with a minimal viable audio quality. Of course, you don't want it sounding bad, but I think people put too much emphasis on the equipment and you really don't need that much to get started. I've been doing it for, I think I only have like 5 episodes. I think I have 4 episodes up and I'm doing another one. And I think it's fun. I mean, I like talking to people. For some reason, I find it more intimidating than doing a YouTube video. I don't know why. It's like the same thing, but I've been having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. And you know, when I got started, Wes Wilson, who has been on this podcast twice, you know, he's the one who kind of like gave me advice. And he was basically the same thing you said. It's like most of the devices that you have, the audio quality is good enough. So just do it. Just start. But, you know, when you go to some podcast groups, like say on Facebook, or on some subreddits, you'd see people there like oh, you gotta have the best microphone and you gotta have like this. And there's a jargon, it's like, oh, you have this audio interface and this mixer. So it becomes intimidating, right? Because you think you need this huge technical skill set to do a podcast. But what you really need to do is get a good enough microphone. And I think most phones have that already. And you can start recording. The only thing I'll say is like your first few times are going to suck, but it's a learning curve. And
right.
You learn by doing it rather than thinking about doing it. So for any of these science communicators that are out there that are thinking about getting into a podcast, that's the only advice I would give is just start. Just do it.
Yeah, and I think they wait for perfection or for things to be really highly polished. That's why it took me so long to get into YouTube, because at the museum, we would make these really polished videos. And I was like, I don't have the time to learn video editing and how to use, you know, cameras or buy good cameras. But really, if you're putting out good content, if you're giving people information that they want to learn about, then you're going to have an audience. And I was listening to this one podcast, and this one woman, she runs a really successful podcast, and it's all about goats. Like that's it. So with podcasting, I mean, the whole world, the whole internet world, you can really niche down to your area of expertise, and an audience will find you.
Yeah, that's true. You know, just produce something and promote the heck out of it as much as it can. And eventually people will find you, your audience will grow, and you'll be a podcaster or science communicator or whatever it is you want to do.
Yes, absolutely. And I think a lot of scientists also think that they need to be like the absolute expert. So when I first started science communication, I would pretty much only write about forest elephants or elephants. And then I kind of ran out of stuff to write about with them. And I was like, what do I do now? Because I wasn't expert enough to talk about anything else. But now, having worked with the public so much, with teachers and giving talks at the museum, I mean, you're really an expert on so many things. Or they see you as an expert on so many things just because you are a scientist or you have your PhD. So don't be scared that you're not the absolute expert. And the cool thing about podcasting is what you're doing right now is you can invite other people onto your podcast. So this is something I plan on doing in the future. I have an episode where I want to talk about birds, and I'm not a bird expert, but I plan on inviting somebody in and having some discussion about birds and how you can make your yard more bird friendly and citizen science for birds and things like that.
Yeah. And you know, the great thing about having a guest on is that it gets other people interested. At least for doing this, the Science Bloggers podcast, I've observed that like when I promote to other groups, the number of members that the request to join actually increases. So it's great marketing for your brand, which is important if you're a science communicator. You know, you have to think of yourself as a brand. You know, whether you plan to make money off of this or not, you know, think of it as a business, and that you need to get people through the door, you know, to listen or to buy your product or, you know, take part in some way.
Yes, absolutely.
And you also have a book coming out. Do you want to talk about the fancy
Yes,
scientist
I'd love
book?
To.
I don't know what you're calling it.
It's not about fancy science at all. I decided to write a book. It's about becoming a wildlife biologist and careers in wildlife biology, because on my blog, the most popular posts were the ones that I wrote about wildlife biology. And I kind of wrote this one a while back, and it was really about like how expectations of wildlife biology did not meet up to the reality of it. And like I mentioned, you know, you imagine you're going to be in the field watching elephants. And I did do that for graduate school. But then once you graduate, you realize you're really in charge of the research project. And once you know how to write papers and analyze data well and write grants, really, that's how you spend all your time. And you are then paying for field assistants to collect the data, or you have graduate students to collect the data for their graduate research projects. And I just felt like before I started graduate school, I didn't have any understanding about that. So I wrote about that, and it was a really popular post. And I was just going to write an ebook about it. And somebody, I forget, Chris from the Grad Bloggers podcast recommended I write a real book from it. And at the same time, I listened to a lot of entrepreneurial podcasts, and this one, A Smart Passive Income, he was writing a book, or he just recently launched a book, and he is a really successful entrepreneur, millionaire. He's been offered by different publishing companies to write books, and he went through the pros and cons of self-publishing versus working with a publishing company, and he actually chose to self-publish. So I was pretty shocked by that. I thought self-publishing I just didn't think it would really go anywhere. But after I listened to that podcast and started looking more into it, I was like, well, I can just self-publish this book. And as I started writing, I realized I had a lot more than an ebook. And it's just such a weird career too. Like you mentioned, nobody talks about becoming a wildlife biologist. And even for students, I'm part of a couple of Facebook groups, they're still very unclear about how things work, like even graduate school. And I was unclear about this too. I had to ask professors, but a lot of people think you apply for it like undergrad. And for us in ecology and wildlife biology, this might not be true for physics, but you really find your advisor first. You find somebody you want to work with, somebody whose research you want to or someone who has research interests similar to yours. And the school is important, but it's really about that advisor. And once they agree to take you on, then you apply. If you apply the other way around, your chances of getting in are not very strong. So just like how to go through the whole process and basically things that I wish I would have known. It's a lot more competitive than I thought. I never wanted to go into academia. And everyone would tell me how competitive academia was, so I was prepared for that. But I really wasn't prepared for how competitive the other jobs were, jobs for nonprofits and government. So I offer advice for people, like knowing what I know now, what I would have done and what they should consider while they're going through the process.
So when does the book come out?
It will be out shortly after Labor Day. I'm actually almost all finished with it. I'm doing like my final edits, and then I have to work on uploading it into Amazon and getting into book form.
Okay, well, be sure to tell me when it comes out, and I'll sort of like blast it out on social media.
Thank you. And if you're a scientist out there, if you wrote a dissertation, you can definitely write a book. I feel like it's much easier than writing a dissertation.
It probably is. Yeah, it's probably more rewarding as well. And I think more people will read that document than your dissertation. You know, it's comparison, like hundreds of people will read your book compared to single digits who will read your dissertation.
It's so true. Like so many graduate students are worried about their dissertation. And I'm just like, just get it done. Not that many people read it anyway. Like
it doesn't. Yeah, it's like 5 people are going to read your dissertation. Like get over it.
You just get it.
No one's gonna care. No, people will care, but you know,
it's more about the publications than it is about the dissertation. Like just finish the dissertation, and then you can turn your chapters into publication, and those are the things that you should invest more time in and maybe stress out a little bit more about.
Right. So I guess we've been talking for quite a while.
Yes, I talk a lot.
No, that's good. It gives people a lot to listen to and think about. But I guess as we start closing, is there anything that you'd like to say or talk about that we didn't have a chance to talk about?
I don't think so. I think just if you're a scientist, I think it's a good idea to start exploring some of these science communication venues. I think it's really fun, and I think we need to stop being so scared to interact with the public. I mean, what's going on right now with the division between science and the public? I mean, it's really quite scary, and we need to start bridging these gaps. For scientists in this area, I also would say, I think it would benefit us a lot to look at social science and how people take in information, because I think a lot of scientists think that if you just give more facts, give more data, then everyone will respond, because that's how we tend to respond. But people are very emotional and values driven. And I would encourage people to look into that side of thing about how we frame our messages, and if we can frame the same messages in ways that are more palatable to the audience we're trying to reach.
Yeah, and I think you're so correct on that part, and especially applies today, especially that we're going through this global pandemic, and a lot of the actions that we're taking have become so politicized.
I know.
Politics gets in the way so many times when it should not. And, you know, we have to realize that we're not just talking about facts. We're talking about, you know, people's belief systems, how they see themselves. So we have a long road ahead, you know, both scientists and science communicators.
Yeah, and I think scientists have finally really realized how important science communication is. I think before, when I was in graduate school, I had to hide it. Like I wouldn't be on Twitter during the day because I was expected to work on my dissertation all the time. But being at the museum has been great for it, because they really understood how important science communication is. But I think with some of the policy changes and things that are happening in our government, people have really understood that, okay, now we need to get serious about not just doing the research, but making sure that people understand it and believe it too.
Yeah, you're right. You know, hopefully we'll get there where we engage with the public, you know, much better than we are doing right now. You know, we have a lot of work to do.
Yes, we do.
So I guess we can close. It was really fun having you, and thank you for doing this with me.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun talking to you.
And I look forward to your book when it comes out. Just tell me where it is. And can you tell us like how people can find you on social media?
I am everywhere as Fancy Scientist. If you just Google Fancy Scientist, I'm the number one result. But yeah, I'm on everything except for TikTok. That's the one I'm resisting joining. I think it's going to be a fad, and I'm resisting it.
Okay, so just look for Fancy Scientist, and you'll find you.
Yes.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Stephanie and learned something from it. Be sure to check her out on social media or listen to her podcast, and check out her book when it comes out. And also don't forget to like, share, subscribe, or leave a comment wherever you listen to this episode. Any support you give this channel goes a long way. And I hope you'll join me next week when I talk to a new science communicator.